Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you all for coming. Several weeks ago, I began to read a book called The Vow-Powered Life by Jan Chosen Sule. I'm sorry, Bays. Pardon me. That was her other name. And it inspired me to read more about the Bodhisattva vows. At the end of the talk, we say the vows, and years ago when we would sit until 9 o'clock after our last sitting, we would also say the vows every evening after Zazen. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. And I wanted to see what other people had to say about these vows, and also I wanted to kind of think about them and see what they meant to me. And so that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. I'd like to start, though, with something from Jan's book, Chosen's book. And it talks about how vows are really an intrinsic part of our lives. They're not just, you know, kind of formal things we take on, but our very life itself is a vow. And our whole life, it manifests itself with that vow. And the very basic part of it is that as soon as we're born, we have a vow to live. And so this life itself is what the vow is. And every moment we're manifesting it, whether we, you know, think about it. It's not really a thought, I'm going to do something. It's more like this sense of living. It's your, you know, your entire life. And this is the first paragraph from the introduction. Vows are the forces that weave together the fabric of your life and all of life. Without vows, without purposeful action, life would cease to exist. Vows are not a mysterious, rare, or arcane activity. Once you learn about vows, you see and hear them everywhere. They pop up in books and magazine articles and movies and in ordinary conversations. They manifest as the book in your hands, the food in your refrigerator, the chair you are sitting on, the shelter over your head. Someone made each of these things, and that someone had to have a vow, a goal, a clear intention in order to make it. Without vows, innovations, and progress would not occur. There would have been no spearheads chipped from obsidian, no written languages, no solar panels, and there will be no future treatment for dementia. I remember many years ago when after I had graduated from college and began working, the job I was doing was it was very interesting, but there was a sense that I should be doing something else. And I find it interesting that I can remember that. I don't know whether it was a moment but it seems like it was just a moment where I said to myself, I want to do something meaningful with my life. And I think that we all have felt that at various times. It happens at different stages in our life, and sometimes just spontaneously. And it's not that you're really thinking about it. It's somehow something that's very deep inside you, and who you are, and how you, and your deepest wish or your deepest aspiration to express yourself, express your life. And so the first thing I don't remember how I got there, but what happened was I ended up volunteering at a foundling hospital with preschool children and toddlers and infants. And all day on Saturday I would be there at the New York Foundling Hospital. And on Sunday I would take one of the children out. And I took one child out for a whole year until she was adopted. She was about a year old when I met her. And then the following year I took out a little boy who was about 5 years old and took him out for a year until he went back to live with his family. And that experience led me to take classes in child psychology and eventually get a graduate degree in early childhood education. And it became my life's work. And I moved around a lot, but wherever I went, I ended up working with children. And I never thought of it as a vow, and that's not the kind of word that I would use. I always thought vows were kind of, well, you get married and you take vows, or you become a priest and you take vows. But actually, all of us in our lives are vowing each moment. And the Bodhisattva vows are the vows that we take when we begin this path of realizing that we're Buddhas. And once we get on this path, we can't get off it, even if we try. I'm sure there are times when all of us have said, no more, no more. And I think even people who have stopped going to Zen centers, once they've experienced the practice, that the aspiration and the intention is still there. And actually, it's the aspiration that probably brings you here to give meaning to your life, a purpose. I'd like to quote something that Coben said. Connectedness of your mind to something keeps your life going with a certain tension, purpose, a sense of your worthiness to exist. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Shujo, Muhen, Seigando. Shujo, beings, all existence. Seems like we think about living beings, but perhaps the rivers and the mountains and the whole world, everything is living. And we vow to be with all existence. Saving is, I think, the word that a lot of people have trouble with in some translations of the vows, that they change that word. There are a lot of different translations of it, of the vows. In a sense, we're all one being. We're all connected, and I think the more that we can realize that we're not separate from each other, the more that we can save all beings, because there's no difference between ourselves and others. And I know I used to wonder, even when I was teaching, I know I had this feeling that I was going to, all the little, these children that had problems, that I was going to make them all perfect and have their lives be wonderful. And of course I did help them. And of course the problems arose again, and so I helped them again. And I think that's what we all do every day with, in each moment, is we be with whatever is there. And I think that willingness to be there is the same as saving. The Buddha said when he awakened that he and all, it said, I and all and the great earth and all beings together have simultaneously attained the way. I found it interesting that I looked up some of these words in the Japanese dictionary, and shujo, muhen, seigando. Shujo is existence, mu is no or nil, and hen means boundary. And in all the translations, it comes out, you know, that they're just immeasurable human beings. But the way I see it is that there's no boundary between existences. And and I think the more that we can realize that, the more that we don't have to worry about saving everybody. It just living this life is the very expression of doing that. And I think when we do Zazen, we are actually doing that. Shikantaza is an expression of saving all beings. The second one, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Bono mujin seigan dan. Bono, those are all our mental afflictions. Greed, hate, delusions. And all those things that come up that that make us feel uncomfortable, and that in a sense those are the things that separate us. Maizumi Roshi, you said that in a way, it means, he said it's not so much these, if anger comes up that it's a bad thing or whatever it might arise that seems like it, we don't have a favorable feeling towards it. It's not that thing in itself. It's more like whether we care about it. So the feelings arise and we just let them go rather than trying to or dig ourselves deeper and let other feelings arise that keep us separate from ourselves and from others. And the Don is to cut, and so we, as things come up, we just cut them off, and they will come up again, and then just cut them off again. The impossibility of these vows, some see it as impossibility or the endless, it's more like the endlessness of it. And so we keep on going, and in a way, it's almost better that they're endless, because it keeps our lives vital and keeps helps us to realize that others will carry on when we're not here. That the vows don't end with our life, in other words, but will continue to go on endlessly. And if we think back to our teachers and our teachers' teachers, they all took on the same vows, and we're continuing to live with these. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Homon Muryo Seigan Gakku. Dharma gates. Our very life is one big Dharma. Sometimes when I say these vows, they all somehow seem the same. They can it be explained in very similar ways. Dharma can be teachings or just the way life is. Kind of like the Buddha, through his meditation, through his sitting, through his facing his mental afflictions. Realize what life was, and then all the teachings came after that. And so when we do our reading and our studying, it's almost like we're we're maybe, in a sense, adding to what already exists. Sometimes putting another head on your own. Sometimes I feel that way when I'm talking and trying to explain things. I feel like I get all mixed up with the words. And the essence. Like there's something extra. I guess we have no choice but to use these words and to talk about our practice. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Butsudo Mujo Seigan Jo. The character for Joe is the character for up above. And so when you put Mu in front of it, it's like nothing is above. So, like when we say don't put another head above your own, that kind of goes with that vow. There's nothing that goes higher than the Buddha's way. That's it. It's unsurpassable, not because we can't pass it, but that's what we want to realize. And it's, as we all know, it's not a matter of getting there. It's a matter of letting it be and realizing it in our lives. In ourselves, that each of us is just that. I save a lot of Dharma teachings, and I have this very old wind bell from 2001, and in it I found very nice writing of Michael Wangers. I think some of you probably know him. He's from Zen Center, and he wrote some beautiful words on these vows that I'd like to share with you. In his introduction, I'll read some of that. To vow is to go beyond, to go from the visible to the invisible, from habit to freedom, from the conditioned to the unconditioned, yet never to land in the visible, the free, or the unconditioned. To vow is to go from what you know, from your highest aspiration, to where it takes you, from your most accurate wish to the ungraspable. From what is possible to what is inconceivable. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Preposterous, this can't be done. I can't save myself, let alone numberless beings. A vow is not what is logically possible. It's about our deepest yearning. If vows were only what you could do, it would be like going to the mall and acquiring what pleases you. Go beyond the possible. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Similarly, ending delusion, is this even possible? You got something better to do? Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. You mean that each situation is an opportunity for liberation? Maybe your life, but not mine. Mel Weitzman asked Suzuki Roshi, "What is nirvana?" He replied, "Seeing one thing through to the end." Can you, in each moment, be completely that moment? Why not? It's worth your best effort. As Katagiri Roshi would say, throw yourself into the house of Buddha. Just enter with your whole body and mind. Wherever you go, there you are. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Me, the world-honored one? Feyn once was asked, "What is the proper way?" He replied, "The first thing is to practice. The second thing is to practice. Jump off the 100-foot pole and go beyond. Don't just sit there. Vow." Well, probably could go on and on, but I think I've said what I've wanted to say. So I would really love for people to express themselves. Thank you. Liz?
Talking about delusions are inexhaustible, and how we can just recognize the thoughts, cut it, they come up again, and you just drop it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we're struggling, that doesn't maybe it doesn't seem like help if somebody tries to just like steer us that way. I'm like, well, just drop that and go this way. Uh-huh. But it completely is. There's no kind of, there's no reworking negative thoughts that has an adequate resolution. But that's the habit energy to kind of keep going over something to try to work it out. So I was just struck by just drop it. Yeah.
Mm. Thank you. Yes. What is your name?
Minoj. At some point you expressed sitting in Zazen it's almost taking the vow of saving other beings.
Mm-hmm.
My partner, my fiance, is a big volunteering spirit. We were just in a training called CASA, which is about saving children, similar to what you
mentioned. Yeah, I know what CASA is.
I always struggle with the amount of spirit of volunteering she has. And for me, it's the moderate effort of taking care of oneself and same time giving to others. So what you said was interesting. So when you relate to Zen practice and taking care of oneself in this practice and all this Zazen as a way of thinking about saving other beings, how would you relate to your volunteering effort prior to that in your life. Where's the balance between practice of saving other beings or taking a vow by doing a sitting practice as it's mm-hmm. going out in the world and really acting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a crucial question. And somehow the sitting practice is, to sit answers that question in a sense. When we do that practice, we cut off our thinking about things, and it affects how we are in the world. And whatever you do in your life is in a sense connected to your sitting practice. It's not a matter of saying, well, I'm going to sit so I'll be a better person. But you somehow you sense that sitting is a way to express yourself and express how you want to live your life. And whatever you do in your life is going to have that expression in it. And you said your wife volunteers for CASA? Yeah, that's...
We both signed up.
Oh, you both. Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah, that's very, very wonderful thing to do.
Right.
Oh. Have you started to help?
It came from a place of, I see her a lot, spending so much energy and getting stressed out, so I'm always telling her, well, it's a balancing act.
Uh-huh.
I'm in the sitting practice, so... When I see her, I feel like I'm not doing enough. But when I see her do as much and she gets drained and loses her balance, then I think, well, it's this balancing act. So it's challenging for even me sometimes to think about the sitting practices. But then after I sit, the experience I could relate to definitely means to me that, like you said, how I show up in the world, even if I will like give back after the sitting, it's much more compassionate than coming from a place of ambition of doing something for the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It has a different energy.
Yeah. Yeah, Koban Chino, who is my first teacher, and he was a teacher here many years ago, he talked about how you're inside your skin is a very, very small part of yourself. And outside your skin is endless. And so when we sit, I think we begin to sense that, and open up to our big self, in other words, the big mind. And so in reading this book, Jan talks about some people who do these fantastic things or have done, real inspirational people like Mother Teresa and Albert Schweitzer and on, and you know, you feel, my goodness, I'm not doing anything. But I know what you mean. I've had that feeling myself sometimes. I think, well, you know, I should be doing more in my life, and you know, maybe sitting is not enough. And but I think at each time in our life we manifest our practice just the way it's supposed to be manifested, and it's okay. Thank you, Nitty.
say a few words about the other aspect of vow, which often goes with it, where we choose to abstain from things because that helps us to fulfill our vows? Could you say
That again?
About we take like precepts to abstain from things, to not do things, and not doing often helps us with our vows to save all beings. So can you say a little bit about sort of the vow, our vows around giving up things and letting go of things?
Giving up things, can you give an example of what?
Like giving up substances, mind-altering substances, giving up things that are distractions.
Oh.
That sort of thing.
Oh. I think that if you sense that it's bad for you to do anything, then if it doesn't help your practice, then you know, I guess you should stop doing it. But I don't think that there is a list of things. And I know that, you know, when in monasteries there's this long list of things that priests aren't supposed to do. But we're not living in a monastery. And I think our practice itself, our sitting or cell itself, naturally teaches us or shows us, oh, I better stop doing that. That's not really good for me, because we just know it. And so I think of it more as a personal vow, maybe, to not do things, as opposed to, you know, a list of things. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
I think you started referring to the precepts, the 10 precepts, which are non-killing, non-lying.
Right.
But when you first started this talk, what I heard was the vows support life, the vows hold life together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just struck me, because they just did for me about 3 months ago. I came out of major abdominal surgery and I'm in pain. And I'm looking at the rest of my life and I'm thinking, I don't want any more of this.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some way I can pull the plug here, or just, you know, off myself and not come out of it? And immediately I said, wait a minute, you took a vow. You have a vow. You made a vow. When I got the rakusu, I made a vow. So I'm not the one that decides when to quit that. It was real simple, because I wasn't thinking, you know, you're not really thinking rocket science stuff here after that. But it was just clear as anything that I had taken a vow. And I'm not the one that says when we stop. And the other thing I remember too was at that low point was when we, I believe that the last thing we do in the ceremony is we request help from all of the Buddhas and ancestors, if I remember it correctly, to support us in these vows. So I said, Buddhas and ancestors, you're on, take it. And they said, you just sit. We can care over us. This is just the simple thoughts that just came. That's that. In that way, the vow supported my life at that moment. And has, you know, continued. And that doesn't mean I'm wildly happy about the way things are. But it also enables me to sit back and say, wait a minute, am I hurting any place? No. Am I, you know, what is so bad about this particular moment? I'm breathing in and breathing out, and it's just same as always. The breath comes in, the breath goes out. And my job is just to stay with that, and the Buddhas and ancestors are going to support me all I need, as well as you will, you know, other practitioners, other people practicing the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, as for becoming Buddhist way of unsurpassable, I better become it. I thought how impossible that was, but I kept getting told by my physician in visits after the surgery. She said, "You just amaze me." I wasn't surprised because I knew the tools that I had.
Mm.
I knew the help, the support that I had from Buddhas and ancestors, and the ability to just let go of everything and just sit, just breathe in and out. And so perhaps that was, in some way, somebody saw that there is a way of being, going through things like this, that maybe it's not like most people you see. Who knows? It was, I was just grateful that I had this to hang on to, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back here.
Mm-hmm.
You're feeling good now? You're feeling okay?
Yeah, I think I always have been. Like the doctors, they keep saying, "You hurt?" Oh, no. Am I supposed to hurt?
Well, thank you.
No, I'm fine.
Good. Thank you, Lenore. Nyla?
I wanted to ask about when you're describing your practice and, I guess, the sitting practice in general as being however much you're practicing at a given moment is kind of what's enough, you know, for you, and almost like this natural kind of flow of your practice. But then how do you combine or balance that kind of intuitive understanding of your practice with maybe a habitual pattern of thinking? So, like, for example, my aspiration to do this practice is based on something like I'm not sitting enough because that's based on a habitual pattern of being somewhat lazy, let's say, or I'm sitting so much and that's maybe coming out of a habitual pattern of self-destruction or self build up your sense of self. So balancing that, I don't know if that makes any sense, but
habitual patterns. So you're asking about habitual patterns and
compared to intuition, I guess, when it comes to your practice.
Well, my experience is that through sitting, I begin to see what my patterns are. And if I feel it's not beneficial to myself or to anyone else, then I would adjust it, perhaps. But I think that's one of the what does come about with everyone is that we begin to see our habits, and to break free of those, so that they're, or what's it's called, our karma. And so instead of being led around by our karma, we become more in charge of. Or a vow takes over, perhaps. You can say that. And I feel that in my life. Sometimes I'll get into that, I see that pattern, and either it's when I'm doing Zazen or when I'm just around the house or whatever. And it's become easier for me to say, "Oh, there I go again." And recognize it. And sometimes I can't get out of it right away. But so I just have to be with it until it goes away. And so when you're sitting with all that stuff. And eventually, you know, you're sitting for 40 minutes and somewhere along the line, it just gets really tiring and old. And somehow something opens up. And that opening can be very small or it can be big or whatever. And so, does that answer your question? Thank you. I don't know how we're doing on time. I don't have a watch.
We can wind up.
Oh, okay. Okay. Unless anyone else has a burning question.